This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Body Bags with Joseph Scott Moore. I'm here to categorically tell you that no, I have never talked to the dead. All those years I've spent with the dead, all these years I've spent with the dead, trying to tell their stories. I've never actually spoken with the dead. As a matter of fact, if I ever do say that, make sure you send the people with the butterfly nets to take me away, because it ain't real. But I will submit to you that the dead can speak to us. They can speak to us in a way that is actually a bit more scientifically based. They tell their stories through all that's left behind, all that remains, if you will. Today, I'm going to tell you the tale of a lady who lost her life at the hands of a monster. And that monster left behind a message in code. As a matter of fact, a message in his DNA. Because, unfortunately, he's no longer around to be held accountable for his brutality. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags. They say, Dave, that our sins will find us out. I've heard that ever since I was a little bitty boy. My grandmother used to actually say that to me.
Nothing is hidden, won't be revealed.
That's right. All shall be revealed. And I can't sit here and definitively say that Othram Labs in Woodlands, Texas, is an instrument in the hand of the Almighty. However, I have been around a lot of other people in my life that claim that they were an instrument in the hands of the Almighty, and I've never seen their fruits. I have seen the fruits of Othram, and I know what they're doing. They are providing information to families, and I got to tell you, wherever there is peace, I have to think that the Almighty is at work, and that's what they're delivering to families, and boy, today do we have a tale to tell.
Margaret Anselmo was 45 years old, Joe. She had two children, and Margaret had a number of issues, but she loved her kids. They were young adults at that point. And we're talking about January 3rd, 1997, by the way. Need to be clear on this. January 3rd, 1997, Margaret, living in an apartment, and she goes to cash a check. And that's the last anyone knew of her until next, her body was found. And I was looking over this, Joe, because Margaret was a floral designer. She just was going to cash a check. A delivery driver found her body face down in a snowy alley. She had been raped and beaten to death. Police believe she was the victim of an apparent random act of violence. Her cause of death, blunt force trauma to the head. Now, Joe, just laying out that scenario, nobody saw what took place. Merely finding the victim after the fact face down in an alley. It's 1997. Nobody's around. Now, we're starting the investigation. What do you do?
Well, you try to take as much care as you can. I got to tell you, when the police would have worked this case, first off, you've got a place that's, let's just face it, you're talking about alleyways. With alleyways, you've got locations that are obscured. You're not going to have a direct line of sight. Many times from the road, there's various places you can hide out down alleyways. And let me give you a little insight to this, because these are sexually related cases. As you know, I've been to London quite a bit, and I got to go over into the hunting grounds of Jack the Ripper and walk through that area. Yeah, and I got to tell you, brother, we were there. Kim and I were there at night, and we were going down to a pub that's in the same area where he operated. And even though there are modern buildings there, there are these alleyways that are adjacent that run off of this main street. And I got to tell you, it gave me the creeps, because you can still to this day, and this is here, this is in 2025. We were just there. All right. I'd never been into that area because I've never been like really into the whole Jack the Ripper thing. But there were, you know, we were staying down in that area. I thought, well, this would be a good opportunity just to go check it out. And it's everything you can imagine plus more relative to the alleyways that are there. We actually came upon one site that we knew was one where one of the prostitutes commonly took her johns, and she's found dead in that area. And it's an alleyway that's very obscured. And she had been brutalized in that particular location. You could literally feel it there because it's still dark. It's very narrow. That building in that area still had the same facade on it. The worn, aged brick. It's not lighted. So when the police, in the case of Margaret's case, all the way back in the mid-90s, when they would have gone down there, they would have, first off, you have to ask yourself this question. Why is this non-infirmed lady in an alley found there, brutalized? You know that this is probably going to be a sexually motivated event. And as it turned out, it was. And the brutality that went along with her death kind of goes hand in hand with the sexual nature of it. You have to be very careful. What's really fascinating about this, Dave, is that this case is in Spokane, Washington, mm-hmm. which is completely different, you know, than like the Seattle area and everything. Right. There's actually snow on the ground here. You don't go to Seattle and see snow. And I wonder if there was evidence in the snow, because they talk about this prominently in this particular case. Were there footprints? Was there any blood deposition there? Was there any evidence that anyone had struggled back and forth, kind of rolling over the surface? The thing about working a case in the snow, which I've not had that many opportunities over the course of my career, because I've spent my career in the South. I have worked a few, is that if you don't document that case almost immediately, man, particularly here down in the South, you're going to lose bits of evidence along the way, because as temperature warms up, all that stuff's going to melt away. So was there anything there that was deposited adjacent to her body that would have provided evidence to give an idea as to the dynamics? Was she drugged down that alleyway? You know, because you can actually see, and you know, you hear about this in movies and see it on crime shows, how people will talk about looking for drag marks. Mm-hmm. Dave, drag marks are a real thing.
Really?
I can sit here and I can tell you affirmatively that they are. I've seen drag marks.
I thought they were creative license. I thought it was, we got to figure out a way that the detectives can figure something out. And now we've got this marking. Okay. And so it's real. That is a thing.
It is real. Wow. And I got to tell you, one of the most prominent cases over the course of my career that I worked involving drag marks was, you know, down here in the South, we have pine forest, and many times these so-called pine forests are more like, I refer to them as pulpwood pines. These things that are planted in a row. And I had a lady that had been raped and murdered out in this area. And you could see where she had been drugged over the bed of pine needles, where she had been fighting. There were scuff marks, you know, where she had been kicking. She was being drugged through this area. And also that had transitioned onto her feet as well, covered in dirt. You could see that there had, in fact, been a struggle. Now, I'm not saying that a pine needle covered surface is the same as a snow covered surface, but it is the same principle. You're looking for any kind of evidence here. Here's another thing. If you think about a sexual assault and the intimacy of this and the violence of it, the perpetrator, not just the victim that may have been drugged back there or restrained back there, the perpetrator is going to leave their own impressions behind too. You begin to think about, nobody in Spokane, Washington, in the wintertime is going to be walking around barefoot, right? So you're thinking, well, were there any footprints at that particular time? Is there something that may have been missed along the way that would have been very specific? And if there were footprints, is it possible that they were just eradicated? They were not good enough to lift something out of. In forensics, you do, there's a wax casting that you can do. And I've never had to do this, but there's a wax casting that you do on prints in the snow. Isn't that fascinating?
Wow.
And it's kind of sprayed on into this, and you can lift this out of the snow. And you have to work really quickly. It's not like you can kind of cut out a block of snow,
right,
and preserve all of the detail from the sole of a shoe and, you know, kind of freeze it and hang on to it. It doesn't work that way. You have to cast it with this wax appliance so that you can lift this, so it's there forever and ever. The problem is that unlike dirt, snow does not hold on to the same detail as dirt does or mud. Okay. So it has to be very, very carefully handled. Now, I'm not saying that that's the case. However, the fact that her body approximated snow, they talk about it being in the snow. I really wonder if there was evidence of that, Dave.
When you're approaching this, where she is found in an alley, and you know that she was walking to cash a check.
Yeah.
Walking down an alley would not be a shortcut, you know, for a professional, somebody who is used to being in an area and going, I'm thinking, what if this individual, the suspect, picks her up somewhere, offers her a drive, it's cold, it's January 3rd, hey, you need a lift, let me help, you know, and she accepts it, he damages her elsewhere and brings her and drops her in the alley.
How do you
figure that one out? Do you look for tire tracks? Are you looking for getaway marks? What if the snow came after you did that?
Yeah, no kidding. So that is significant. And I can't tell you over the course of my career how many times I've literally called. There was in Atlanta when I was working there. I had a relationship with a meteorologist at one of the local stations who had an interest in crime, believe it or not. Wow. We had just met. And anytime I needed anything relative to the weather, I would contact this person and they would help me out. A lot of it had to do with the rising and falling of river levels and lake levels, but I could also get a sense because they can tune in to things like environmental temperature, very specific to our region. Like, you know, what was the air temperature like at this particular time? And I had availed myself of their services. So if you're talking about snowfall and snow deposition, you'd really begin to wonder when was the last snow that fell, when exactly and how much snow was deposited during that period of time. And you have to kind of bounce that off of when she was last seen in life making her way to go cash a check. And what was her normal route? How far away from her point of origin was this alleyway? Was it a location that she would normally pass? Because here's the thing, if she had created kind of a known path where you're walking this predictable route every single time, we've heard about this before, and you're being observed and you draw the eye of somebody, some cretin is there watching you, particularly some, you know, defenseless woman that's just about her business. She might be afraid to be in the area in the first place. She's clutching her purse. She's trying to get to the location to cash this check. There's no telling whose eyes are upon you. But this is the case with Margaret. We don't know if anybody saw her walking through there. We don't know if this monster made visual contact with her came up behind her and attacked her. But he did, in fact, leave a calling card. A calling card that would tell Margaret's story of horror. From an investigative perspective, Dave, when I would go into a case that involved, say, for instance, a rape homicide, there was something about those cases that was so horrible in the sense that not only had somebody been robbed of their life, but there is physical evidence there. You can visualize it, okay, of the terror that this person probably went through. You see the disheveled clothing. You see a shirt and a bra that is many times not removed. And this happened more than once in these cases, but it's pushed up to expose the breast. You'd be surprised how many of those there are out there. You know, you think about, you see something in media where people are ripping clothes. Many times clothes will be pushed up, okay, and pulled down. It's not so much a ripping away of clothing. Many times the victim is so terrified that they facilitate this. They want it to be over with. But if you have someone that has, and I got to tell you, in this particular case, Dave, given the nature of this, that somebody that is infected with a bloodlust like this, they're going to do anything and everything they can to completely dominate and control. And I think that that's what happened in Margaret's case. The big key here, though, is they're talking about a bludgeoning, a beating, if you will. I really wonder if it was hands and feet or if there was actually an object involved in this, Dave.
Wow. You know, one of the things they did is pretty standard. There is an SOP for everything, standard operating procedure.
Oh, yeah.
And in this particular case, I looked up what was traditional in 1997 in Spokane, Washington, and what they did was right off the chain, mainly because you are dealing with a scenario where you have no witnesses, you have only a finder who is a delivery guy,
yeah,
and you have a victim. So you're starting with nothing except for the body, her routine, and, well, there was some DNA.
Yeah.
And in 1997, traditional STR DNA profile was developed. Now, what is STR DNA profile, Joe?
Short tandem repeats. And so what you're looking at is that the there's little markers along the strand that you're trying to marry up those markers so that they tell the story at a molecular level of who this person is. Now, dependent upon the sourcing of this DNA and when they applied STR methodology to it, the next step, and we even had this back then, Dave, is they plug it into CODIS, which is the national database. And as you well know, because you've covered so many of these cases, Dave, the chances that you're going to get a hit seem to be most of the time more or less than great. You know, there, because you know what you're looking at with CODIS is that there's two categories, and forgive me if I'm beating a dead horse, but I have to remind everybody here that you have these known individuals that are sex offenders, and then you have the unknowns, which is traditionally what's referred to as the forensic database. So if with this STR analysis that they've run, they're looking into the known. So these are people that have been found guilty of some kind of sex offense. They're required to give up their DNA. It's deposited into the system. And back then, the search was a bit more difficult going back all those years with CODIS. It's not quite as it's more seamless now than it was back then. And a lot of that has to do with advances in technology. But you look first in the known database, and the unknown database arises from the samples that they've gotten from all these other cases, like Margaret's case, for instance,
right,
where you have viable sample, but this person's not in the database. Who are you going to match it up with? And so all of these years have gone by, Dave. All these years have gone by, and there was still no match, or the case had fallen so far down the list. Because remember, we're talking mid-90s, Dave.
Mm-hmm.
You think there's been other unsolved cold cases that have occurred in Spokane, Washington since then? Of course there have been. And it's really tragic because these cases get stacked one upon another.
Right.
And those cases begin to disappear in the rearview mirror. And I know that's very sad, you know, but that's the reality. You can only work so many of these cases.
Everybody has a job, you know, and we all know you have a certain amount that is expected every day. And then you have other stuff that piles on top of that.
Yeah.
And that's what happens with cases. If you, in a case like her, and again, Margaret was not just kicked to the curb and, you know, they did everything they could. They interviewed everyone in the area they could find. They tried every known way of accomplishing this, and they didn't give up by just kicking it, filing it, and being done with it. They actually did keep returning to it to see if they could find anything. But, you know, it doesn't do any good to have DNA if the person has never had the suspect has mm-hmm. never had their DNA taken and placed in the system. You can have the DNA all day long, yeah. but if they're not in the system, you got nothing to compare it to.
No.
And until you and that's where the development of some of the cases we've had recently that Authorm is doing, it's because they're able to now use this incredible technology. Okay, we don't have that guy, but you know what? We do have something over here. We can file, you know, and they start pulling that DNA strand apart. In this case, it took until 2022, Joe. Now, one thing I try to do on these cases, I look at family members, you know, because I always wonder what would they be going through? Not knowing, you know, your mom is dead, you know? I found out a little bit about her daughter, and her daughter was sad because she was such a loving, beautiful woman, but she did have some mental health issues.
Yeah.
And that is kind of why she was living in an apartment and was not living with. Now, her daughter was 19 at the time. Her son was same, I think 18. But any way you look at it, she did not live a life on the edge. She wasn't a drug user. She wasn't a partier. She wasn't that. You know, she wasn't any of the things that could put somebody at risk. This is a florist. Yeah, she designed floral arrangements for crying out loud
for
weddings and funerals. Think about that for just a minute. And when they couldn't solve it, they kept coming back to it. They kept trying to. And finally, it took years, but finally, they were able to submit to Authorm. And, you know, that's an undertaking in and of itself. Because you submit what you have, and they start working on it. And they come up with a few ideas and a few, you know, and they send it back to you. And now the police are working it again. And they tie some more things together. They send that back. And each time it's a couple of months in between. It's not like they call Joe and say, hey, Joe, you got any DNA there we can run? And you send it to them. And then a week later, they go, yeah, we found this murder from 30 years ago. Here you go. We're talking, it's a years long process.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of continually working to unfold this entire origami, you know, of evidence. And
that's a great way to put it. It is very complex, and, you know, and it's not just with Authorm. It's not just the DNA scientist. And I know I've told you this before because we talk about these cases with some frequency, but when you walk into this, the only way I can really describe it for those that have not seen images of Authorm, it's like walking into some futuristic lab. You feel like you're on some kind of starship somewhere. But it's not just the people behind those glass walls where you can see through and you can see what they're doing. It's the other side of the house too, where these people are literally trying to fashion family trees, which is intellectually, it's also a huge puzzle to put these things together to try to understand the genealogy. And that's, you know, what eventually leads back to whoever this might be, or at least a close relative.
You know, it was a relative. That's the thing. They were able to identify somebody who is a relative of that suspect you have over that unknown subject over here.
Yeah.
Well, we found somebody that person is related to. And Joe, I think about that. And I think that goes beyond the scope of what my head is capable of handling. That you haven't identified the suspect, but you identified this person over here that is so far away from him or her. You know, they don't even know each other, maybe.
I read it the other day, and I wanted to share this with you, Dave, because it kind of dovetails with the conversation we're having right now about, because you said unknown, and it brought it to mind again for me. And let this kind of seep in here, this discussion we're having. This item that I had read said that the days of the tomb of the unknown soldier are going to be passing us by. Just imagine that just for a second. That's the power of this technology. You know, people that have fallen in battle, and you can go to graveyards. You know, we have them all over the South, where you have, say, Civil War graveyards. You can walk through them, and there'll be these headstones, and it'll say things like, you know, like it says on, I think at the tomb in Arlington, it says known only to God, or it'll say unknown. This technology is now at a point now, Dave, where those days are going to be passing us by very quickly. I mean, just think about, you know, because, you know, some time back, you know, we talked about the King in the Car Park with Richard III.
Yeah.
Dude, he was killed in battle before Columbus discovered America. All right. Before 1492, he was back in the 1300s. They got him identified through one of his descendants. Okay. That's the world that we're living in now. And that's what makes this tool that we have at our disposal, and that Othram has facilitated, you know. And you go back to what David Middleton has said about, you know, the nameless list, those thousands and thousands of people that are on this thing, and they are all individual people. His goal is to clear that list out one by one. I don't care how long it takes. That's what his goal is. And for Margaret's case, her case, all the way back all these years ago, there in Spokane, down in that dirty little alley, it seemed to come to an end then. But you know what? Her story continued with the end of the life of her perpetrator. Don't know if you and I have had this discussion before. However, I will repeat it.
Okay.
Did you know I've investigated more suicides in my career than I have homicides?
Wow. No, you haven't told me that.
Yeah, they outpace homicides.
Wow.
3-1, 2-1, depending upon the jurisdiction. You just don't hear about them unless it's like Robin Williams. All right. Unless the media actually says this person's important. I hate that.
Yeah.
And we're going to name who it is, you know, because if you go to the newspaper, I say newspaper.
Yeah.
So, you know,
news resources.
Thank you very much. I don't remember the last time I went to a paper box and dropped coins in it. And I don't even know if they have those anymore.
They have them right next to the payphones.
You know, there was a certain amount of joy that I would derive from that, though. from actually getting the newspaper and physically holding it.
Getting your cigarettes from the machine.
Exactly. they're out of Marlboros. but, you know, you go to the obits in the, you know, in the newspaper, and it'll give somebody's age. There, it'll say, you know, John Jones, 29, died suddenly.
Right.
And so that's really all you ever, you know about a suicide, unless you're associated with a family.
Yeah. And if the family wants you to know,
And
oftentimes now they are sharing things, thankfully, about mental health.
Yes.
And there are warnings about it because, you know, Joe, I didn't put two and two together. I didn't realize a lot about homicides versus suicides until I started noticing how, when you mention suicide, you know, this is a big deal to talk about because so many people feel like you got it. Look, man, you're taking a permanent, you're making a permanent decision for a very temporary problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
So don't, please.
Yeah. And that's something that, you know, we deal with all the time in my field where we go out and drifting back, putting my forensic hat on, we work all of those suicides because it is a violent death.
Right.
We work them all as if they're homicides until we can prove otherwise. And so we're very careful about that because you have to be. You get one shot at it.
Oh, buddy.
But how it's weird. It almost seems like, and I'd really like to know the attitude of the police because it's like they've got, in one hand, they've got this case. Margaret's case that has just been lingering and on the books for all of these years. And they're hoping against hope. They're going back, checking it periodically. There's other cases coming in. And finally, they do have a ray of hope relative to identifying who this person was that perpetrated this rape homicide. And can you imagine? I wonder if when they made the ID, if they were deflated, Dave, over the fact that this person could not, at least in this world, could not be held accountable for what he had perpetrated against Margaret and her family.
They were able to, using the DNA that was taken from Margaret when her body was discovered in that alley, and even though it took many, many years, they were able to finally determine that that DNA came from Brian James Anderson. Brian Anderson, he was 20 years old when he committed this crime, this murder, this rape, this horrible, vicious assault. He's a 20-year-old man, and he's beating up a 45-year-old woman and raping her and leaving her like trash in an alleyway. And after they figured out who he was, found out he was born April 29th, 1976, and died by suicide July 8th, 2009. I cannot imagine what the investigators felt because they solved it. And they said, in their announcement, Joe, they said, if he were alive, we have the evidence to charge him with this and get a conviction. That's the one thing. It wasn't just this DNA. They had other evidence to go along with it that all matched up once they identified him.
Right. And so, investigatively, many times the clouds begin to part.
Right.
You know, you see, because then you know, that big blank that you have in your brain when you're trying to figure out a puzzle and you get one piece of the puzzle, and then all of a sudden everything else, there's clarity added to
right.
it. It's like, oh my God, I can't believe I missed this. Yeah. And now, you know, almost like a spider web, you see all of the connectivity that runs through it.
I wanted to be clear on that, Joe. The Spokane Police Department said if he were still alive, they would seek to charge him with first degree murder and first degree rape.
Yeah. Which for those of you that don't know, anytime you hear that term first degree, it means a couple of things. In many jurisdictions, that means that there are aggravating circumstances. Like I'll give you, for instance, if you commit an armed robbery, for instance, and you happen to kill somebody in the commission of an armed robbery, that's an aggravating circumstance, and that can be first degree homicide. You go to some states and they don't have the degrees like this. Like you go to Georgia and they'll call it malice murder. And I still have a hard time kind of wrapping my brain around that statute. But in Louisiana, you know, where I learned criminal law as an undergraduate, you know, first degree murder, and it's murder there, you know, that's a death penalty case. And there's certain aggravating circumstances, you know, that make it that way. Like if you kill somebody under 12, or you kill a school teacher or a firefighter or a police officer while they're working, that's first degree homicide.
Wow.
Commission of an armed robbery, commission of a rape, all those sorts of things. So I'm thinking that's those two things go hand in hand with this case, where, you know, the circumstances were so over the top that if they had a chance to drag him into a courtroom, there's a good possibility they would have gotten a conviction on this guy. Because Dave, when it comes to DNA, you cannot fight these numbers. The only thing you can fight, and here's the way I look at it, the only thing that the defense can put up relative to a defense against the utility of DNA in court is procedurally. How was it collected? How was it protected? How was it analyzed? Because if you follow the recipe that you're supposed to follow every single time you get one of these samples and you treat it as if it's the most fragile thing in the world, which, by the way, kind of is, mm-hmm. and you follow through with all of the steps prescribed by law, then you got a winner on your hands. You know, when you start to get up into these astronomical numbers that, you know, that go back to a specific identity, it's something that people won't soon forget. I think that's why DNA in particular, it has two utilities. First off, a lot of these cases, it's not just about convicting people, Dave. It's about people that have been wrongly convicted, okay? Right. Where you can take it, and the cops were looking at a completely different direction, or there was some kind of malfeasance where they convinced somebody to admit to something they haven't done, and they go back and examine the DNA, which is, you know, it's pretty amazing when you think about it. But here's one more bit to this case that I found absolutely fascinating. Did you know, Dave, that this case is the 41st case that the state of Washington has utilized the services of Othram? Wow. And they've gotten off the books.
Wow.
So I don't know who's been listening to the gospel of Othram up in Washington, but yeah. I think you got a bunch of true believers up there.
Yeah.
They see the utility of what can happen. What can happen when you take this evidence and you apply it and use it for the good that it serves. It's quite amazing that all of these cold cases that they have up there, whether they were unidentified bodies or unidentified perpetrators that had committed some kind of heinous act, Dave, they're mm-hmm. off the books now, man.
Love it. It's one of the most amazing things. And as we try to point out every time, Othram is not funded by the government. They don't have a money tree out in the backyard. They actually have to crowdfund to begin a lot of the projects they're working on. A lot of it comes, like, even from a police department, when they submit DNA, there has to be money. They have to have $7,500 to begin. And I'm going to be honest, Joe, that's not very much money when you look at what they're doing.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where if you want to get involved, you can. You actually yes. can take part in this. And it might not be your family. You might not have anything in your family but what if you knew somebody that had a death of a loved one and there was never anyone held responsible? You know, you could actually be a part of finding that solution for somebody else.
Yes, you absolutely could. And here's what I suggest. If you go to DNASolves.com, you can look through the cases that are right now pending that they need that one little push to get them over the hump in order to begin the wheels rolling, if you will, to flip the switch. This is the perspective I ask you to at least consider. You know, we always talk about the people nowadays like to throw around the term family and community. And if you live in a specific geographic location in the U.S., or maybe that's your point of origin, someplace that was your old hometown, go through there and find something that catches your interest. Maybe, you never know, you might have had some kind of connection to somebody that is missing. There's unidentified remains in your old hometown or somewhere in the state that you love. If you want to send money that way, send it that way. And all you have to do is go to dnasolves.com, look through the cases, and you can give as much or as little as you wish. But listen, there is, in fact, a need. People are banging on all the time about how much they wish they could be a detective. Well, I'm not saying you're going to get a gold badge. However, I can tell you this, by a contribution that you might make to Othram, you're doing more than a lot of people have ever done that were, in fact, so-called investigators. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags.